If the answer leapt out at you, then you probably have an innate talent for finding word patterns. We have seen this kind of thinking talent in great computer programmers. Like them, you might also love crossword puzzles and brain teasers. But perhaps you didn't see the answer immediately. If so, don't worry. We will try to teach you a skill that will help you improve your pattern-finding performance. The skill has three steps. 1. Identify what seems out of place in the word. 2. Evaluate where it is in relation to the whole word. 3. Combine steps 1 and 2 to discover the phrase. Thus, with this first puzzle, the number 1 is out of place. Where is it in relation to the whole word? It's in the middle. So by combining these two facts, you discover the phrase 1 in a million. Simple, really. Now try gaining some experience at applying this new skill. Can you see the well-known phrase in this word? P-A-Y. With the letter A elevated above the P and Y. What is out of place? The letter A. Where is it in relation to the rest of the word? It is raised and in the middle. The solution, A raise in pay. How about this one? The word temperature with the letter A lower than the other letters. What is out of place? The letter A again. Where is it in relation to the rest of the word? It is dropped and in the middle. The solution, A drop in temperature. One more. The word grace with the letter A, both lower than the other letters and tilted downward. Hopefully, the solution is starting to come a little quicker. A fall from grace. Okay, you have had the opportunity to learn a new skill and to gain some experiential knowledge at applying this skill, just as you provide to your people in the real world. But now we are going to change the rules on you, just as in the real world. Can you see the well-known phrase in these words? The number 1, followed by the word thought. Then, the number 2, followed by the word thought, with the word but above it. This one is a little harder, but if you have the innate thinking talent for perceiving patterns, then once again the solution should gradually emerge. But on second thought. But if you don't have this talent, then the skills and knowledge you just acquired didn't help you at all, did they? Lacking the talent, your performance suffered when you were confronted with a novel situation not covered in your training. The same thing happens in the real world. Let's say you have just trained some new associates in the skills and knowledge they need to provide good customer service. You send them out into the field. As long as the customer's requests stay within the guidelines covered in training, most of the associates perform acceptably well. But what happens when, all of a sudden, they are confronted by a customer request that they have never heard before? If they have the relating talent of empathy and/or persuasion, they will perform well. Instinctively, they will find just the right words and just the right tone to calm the customer down and resolve the situation. But if they lack these talents, all the skills and knowledge they have just acquired will be of little help. Their performance will suffer. The power of skills and knowledge is that they are transferable from one person to another. Their limitation is that they are often situation-specific. Faced with an unanticipated scenario, they lose much of their power. In contrast, the power of talent is that it is transferable from situation to situation. Given the right stimulus, it fires spontaneously. If you have the striving talent of competitiveness, then almost any kind of contest can spark you. If you have the relating talent of empathy, then every emotion speaks to you. If you have the relating talent of assertiveness, then no matter what the subject, you will be able to state your case plainly and persuasively. The limitation of talent, of course, is that it is very hard to transfer from one person to another. You cannot teach talent. You can only select for talent. Simple language, smart thinking. Now that you know the difference among skills, knowledge, and talents, you can use these terms to shed light on all the other words used to describe human behavior. Words like competencies, habits, attitude, and drive. Many of us assume that they all mean virtually the same thing. We use phrases like interpersonal skills, skill set, work habits, or core competencies so naturally that we rarely question their true meaning. This isn't just careless language, it's careless thinking. It leads managers astray. It leads them to waste precious time, effort, and money trying, with the best of intentions, to train characteristics that are fundamentally untrainable. So let's look more closely at competencies, habits, attitude, and drive. Which of these are skills or knowledge, and therefore can be changed in a person, and which are talents, and therefore cannot? Competencies. Developed by the British military during World War II to define the perfect officer, competencies are now used in many companies to describe behaviors that are expected from all managers and leaders. Although no one really believes that this perfect manager/leader exists, competencies can occasionally be useful if they help a company think through the ideal set of behaviors for a particular role. But if you do use them, be careful. Competencies are part skills, part knowledge, and part talent. They lump together haphazardly some characteristics that can be taught with others that cannot. Consequently, even though designed with clarity in mind, competencies can wind up confusing everybody. Managers soon find themselves sending people off to training classes to learn such competencies as strategic thinking, attention to detail, or innovation. But these aren't competencies. These are talents. They cannot be taught. If you're going to use competencies, make it clear which are skills or knowledge, and therefore can be taught, and which are talents and therefore cannot. For example, a competency such as implements business practices and controls is a skill. All managers can learn it to some minimum degree of proficiency. A competency such as calm under fire is a talent. You cannot teach someone to be cool under pressure. Habits. Habit is another potentially confusing term. We have been told that our habits are second nature. We have been told that we can all change this nature and acquire new habits. Again, this advice is well-intended, but inaccurate. Most habits are our first nature. Most habits are talents. If you are habitually assertive, or habitually empathic, or habitually competitive, then you are going to have a tough time changing these habits. They are enduring. They make you, you. It's potentially disastrous to suggest that the only way to become more effective is to try to change your first nature. Of course, this doesn't mean that you cannot change some of your behaviors. You can. Over time, through reflection, you might change your values, and so learn a more positive and productive way to apply your talents. You might choose to play to one talent more than another. You might combine your talents with relevant skills. You might learn to accept your unique combination of talents and so become less defensive or insecure. There is a great deal you can change. But whatever you do, the beauty of this approach is that it relies on self-awareness rather than self-denial to help you become more effective. Some of your behaviors may have changed, but you haven't been forced to contort yourself into someone else. You have simply cultivated your unique set of talents. Attitude. Many managers say they select for attitude, a positive attitude, a team-focused attitude, or a service-oriented attitude. For the most part, they are right to do so, because a person's prevailing attitudes are part of her mental filter. They are created by the interplay of her unique pattern of highways and wastelands. While managers can create attitudes through the conditions they establish for employees, attitudes are also reflective of talents. An individual may be cynical or trusting. She may be an optimist or a malcontent. She may be experimental or conservative. None of these attitudes are necessarily better than any of the others. None of them will prevent a person from playing certain roles extremely well. For example, the malcontent might be a powerful entrepreneur, driven by her dissatisfaction with the status quo. The cynic might fit right into a role in law, policing, or investigative reporting, anywhere a healthy mistrust is a prerequisite. But all of these attitudes form part of the person's recurring patterns of thought, feeling, or behavior. Everyone has set points or baseline levels of optimism and pessimism, for example, that fluctuate based on the environment they're in. Managers may be able to change someone's mood from one day to the next, or to create engaging workplace conditions that raise general optimism. However, managers will always struggle to change someone's prevailing attitudes. As Mick Kay, a manager in a large consulting company, describes it, "If I find myself telling the same person to look on the bright side time and time again, I should take a hint. He's not a bright sider. He's a dark sider. I should stop wasting my breath and try to find a role where skepticism is key to success." Drive. Many managers make a distinction between talent and drive. They often find themselves counseling someone by saying, "Look, you are very talented, but you need to apply yourself or that talent will go to waste." This advice sounds helpful. More than likely, it is well-intended. But fundamentally, it is flawed. A person's drive is not changeable. His mental filter, the relative strength or weakness of the highways in his mind, decides what drives him. His drives are, in fact, his striving talents. Take the striving talent of competitiveness as an example. Some people have a four-lane highway for competition. Show them scores, and they will instinctively try to use those scores to compare their performance with that of their peers. They love scores, because what you can measure, you can compare. And if you can compare, you can compete. However, people with a wasteland for competition will see the same scores and not feel any jolt of energy at all. Putting themselves on a level playing field, pitting their best efforts against their peers, and winning means nothing to them. They rationalize their behavior by opining, "I don't like competition. I prefer win-win scenarios." Or the classic, "I prefer to compete with myself." But these comments are just signs that their filter is, understandably, trying to describe itself in the most positive light. The truth is that they are not competitive. There is nothing good or bad about this, it is simply who they are. And there is not much that either they or you, their manager, can do about it. Similarly, some people have a four-lane highway for constant achievement. A striving talent we call achiever. They may not have to win, but they do feel a burning need to achieve something tangible every single day. And these people mean every single day. For them, every day, work day, weekend, vacation, starts at zero. They have to rack up some numbers by the end of the day to feel good about themselves. This burning flame may dwindle as evening comes, but the next morning it rekindles itself, spurring its host to look for new items to cross off his list. These people are the fabled self-starters. Not all roles require employees to possess this striving talent of achiever. Nurses, for example, do not have to generate all of their drive from within. Instead, they have to respond caringly and efficiently to the urgent needs that face them every day. For nurses, the altruistic striving talent of mission is much more important than achiever. But if you manage roles that do require achiever, like an insurance agent, a pharmaceutical salesperson, or any role where the person must initiate rather than respond, then remember, you had better select for it. Because if a person does not feel this burning fire, you cannot light it for him. The same applies to all striving talents. The need to be of service, the need to be on stage, the need to be seen as competent, or the need to help others grow. All of these drives are talents, and therefore they have the same characteristics as other talents. Namely, they are part of each person's mental filter. They are unique and enduring. A manager can never breathe motivational life into someone else. All she can do is try to identify each employee's striving four-lane highways, and then, as much as possible, cultivate them. More on this in Chapter 5. When describing human behavior, we advise you to stick with the clarity of skills, knowledge, and talents. Tread carefully when using habits or competencies. They lump too much together rather haphazardly. Likewise, if you feel a need to use attitude or drive, be cautious. Remember that a person's drive and her prevailing attitudes are reflective of talents. And as such, they are very hard to change. When you hear yourself telling someone to get a better attitude, watch out, you might be asking her to tackle the impossible. None of this implies that a person cannot change. Everyone can change. Everyone can learn. Everyone can get a little better. The language of skills, knowledge, and talents simply helps a manager identify where radical change is possible and where it is not. The world according to talent. Which myths can we now dispel? Guided by their own beliefs and supported by recent scientific advances, great managers can now dispel two of the most pervasive management myths. Myth number one. Talents are rare and special. There is nothing particularly special about talents. If talents are simply recurring patterns of thought, feeling, or behavior, then talents are actually rather commonplace. Everyone has certain recurring patterns of behavior. No one can take credit for their talents. They are an accident of birth. The clash of the chromosomes, as ethologist Robert Ardrey described them. However, each person can and should take credit for cultivating his unique set of talents. The best way to help an employee cultivate his talents is to find him a role that plays to those talents. Employees who find such roles are special. They are naturally able to do what someone is prepared to pay them to do. We rightly label these people talented. Take nursing as an example. Working with a large healthcare provider, Gallup had a chance to study some of the best nurses in the world. As part of our research, we asked a study group of excellent nurses to inject 100 patients and a control group of less productive nurses to perform the same injection on the same population of 100 patients. Although the procedure was exactly the same, the patients reported feeling much less pain from the best nurses than from the rest. Why? What were the best nurses doing to lessen the pain? Did they have some special technique with the needle? Did they apply the disinfectant using a firmer hand or a softer swab? Apparently not. Apparently, it all came down to what the nurse said to the patient right before the needle punctured the skin. The average nurses introduced themselves with a brisk, "Oh, don't worry, this won't hurt a bit," and then plunged the needle in with businesslike efficiency. The best nurses opted for a different approach. They were just as efficient with the needle, but they set the stage rather more carefully. "This is going to hurt a little," they admitted, But don't worry, I'll be as gentle as I can. The best nurses were blessed with the relating talent, empathy. They knew the injection would hurt, and each of them, in their own style, felt compelled to share that knowledge with the patient. Surprisingly, this confession eased the patient's pain. To the patients, it seemed as though the nurse was, in some small way, going through the experience with them. The nurse was on their side. The nurse understood. So when the needle broke the skin, somehow it didn't feel as bad as they thought it would. The relating talent of empathy is not particularly special. Many people have it and call on it in all aspects of their life. But people with empathy, who become nurses, are special. They can share a patient's pain. They are talented. Similarly, some people are fascinated with risk. This striving talent is neither a good thing nor a bad thing. Although it can prompt some otherwise normal people to hurl themselves out of planes or swim with great white sharks just for the fun of it. However, if these people become anesthesiologists or surgeons, then their four-lane highway for risk becomes a positive. For them, the literal life-or-death quality of their work is a thrill, not a pressure. They are special, these people. They are talented. The same goes for the person with the talent for remembering names as well as faces. This talent is nice to have, but it becomes particularly valuable if she is hired as the concierge in a hotel. In all of these situations, the talent alone isn't special. It is the matching of the talent with the role that is special. As with the performing arts, the secret to great performances is all in the casting. Of course, in today's highly specialized business world, finding the right fit between the person and the role is more challenging than it used to be. It is not enough to say, "This person has a talent for assertiveness. I think I'll hire him to sell." You have to know specifically what kind of selling you are going to ask him to do. For example, to be a great salesperson for IBM, as in many sales roles, you have to love pushing for the close, a striving talent, and you have to know exactly when and how to do it, a relating talent. These talents, among others, are critical to an individual's success in the role. But if you are a salesperson for Merck, the pharmaceutical giant, you'd better not have these talents, because you'll never have a chance to use them. The job will quickly frustrate you. The goal of pharmaceutical sales is for the sales representative to build up influence with the doctor or the HMO gradually, so that over time, more of your drugs are prescribed. Here, success has a great deal to do with the sales rep's relating talent for patients and influence, and almost nothing to do with a talent for closing. As a manager, your job is not to teach people talent. Your job is to help them earn the accolade talented by matching their talent to the role. To do this well, like all great managers, you have to pay close attention to the subtle but significant differences between roles. Myth number two. Some roles are so easy they don't require talent. The famous management theorist Oscar Wilde once said, "A truth ceases to be a truth as soon as two people perceive it." All right, so Mr. Wilde was better known for his wit than for his management advice. Nonetheless, every manager should be required to remember this one remark. Although he phrased it in the extreme, Mr. Wilde simply meant that the only truth is your own. The world you see is seen by you alone. What entices you and what repels you, what strengthens you and what weakens you, is part of a pattern that no one else shares. Therefore, as Mr. Wilde said, no two people can perceive the same truth because each person's perspective is different. This can be both a blessing and a curse. You are blessed with a wonderfully unique filter, but cursed with a systematic inability to understand anybody else's. True individuality can be lonely. One way to cope with this loneliness is to succumb to the illusion that other people operate under many of the same assumptions as you. Your ambitions, passions, likes, and dislikes are not special or distinct. They are normal, so you are normal. In moments of calm objectivity, you may concede that your point of view is not the only one, but day to day, it is simply easier if you assume that everyone shares your viewpoint. Of course, this is a generalization. Some people, particularly empathic people, seem able to genuinely walk a mile in someone else's moccasins. Nonetheless, it is a generalization that pervades the working world. Many managers look at lower-level roles like housekeeping or outbound telemarketing and wonder, how could anyone want to do that job? That job must be so demoralizing. Misled by the illusion that everyone shares their filter, they make two false assumptions. First, virtually anyone with the right training could do the job adequately. And second, everyone, regardless of who they are, will want to be promoted out of the job as soon as possible. With the best of intentions, they then define these roles as entry level and build career paths and compensation plans that reward top performers with speedy promotion out of the drudgery. Great managers do not believe that their filter is common to everyone. Instead, when they select for a role, they are guided by the belief that some people are probably wired to excel at the role and to derive enduring satisfaction from doing it well. Gallup research confirms this belief. Let's take hotel housekeepers as an example. Most of us haven't spent much time mulling over the details of housekeeping, but consider for a moment what hotel housekeepers do and how often they have to do it. Put yourself in their shoes. Okay. Two things might have occurred to you. First, that this is an easy job anyone with a modicum of responsibility can do. And second, that this is a terrible job that everyone, including housekeepers, must hate to do. If these thoughts crossed your mind, then you would be wrong on both counts. We shouldn't devalue housekeepers. Anyone can probably clean a hotel room once in a while, but great housekeepers are special. Every day, they vacuum themselves out of each room, knowing that the next day they will return to find the room hit by the usual tornado of towels, toiletries, and bed linen. It is enough to make Sisyphus weary, endlessly pushing his rock up the hill. But great housekeepers don't get weary. They get stronger. They are not beaten down by the relentless grind of their work. On the contrary, they seem to be energized by it. In their mind, their work asks them to be accountable, to be creative, and to achieve something tangible each and every day. They want to come in and attack their section of rooms. The challenge gives them strength. All this is so because great housekeepers possess a certain special set of talents. Does this sound incongruous? What follows may give you a clearer sense of some of the talents needed to be a great housekeeper. A large entertainment company asked Gallup to help it find more housekeepers like its best. This company already knew how special housekeepers were. Leaders in service quality the world over, it had more than 15,000 hotel rooms, cleaned by over 3,000 housekeepers. But to maintain its edge over competitors, the company wanted to learn more about what made its best the best. We had assembled 8 of the company's best housekeepers around a table. Some were shy, perplexed by being asked to talk about their work. Others were completely relaxed, chatting away in English or Haitian Creole or Portuguese. One of them had been a housekeeper for only 18 months, while another had cleaned the same section of rooms in the same hotel for 23 years. They were different races, sexes, and ages, but they were all great housekeepers. Our goal was to encourage them to talk about their work, to see what, if anything, these eight great housekeepers had in common. "How do you know if a room is clean?" we asked them. They said that the last thing they did before leaving a room was to lie on the guest's bed and turn on the ceiling fan. "Why?" "Because," they explained, "that is the first thing that a guest will do after a long day out. They will walk into the room, flop down on the bed, and turn on the fan. If dust comes off the top of the fan, then no matter how sparkling clean the rest of the room was, the guest might think it was as dirty as the top of the fan." We asked them if they were front of house or back of house. In many hotel companies, housekeepers are considered back of house staff. "Front of house. I'm always on stage. Always, always." A grumpy chorus of English, Creole, and Portuguese. "Why do you say you are on stage?"
"Because we make a show for our guests. Unless the guests object, we will take the toys that the children leave on the bed, and every day we will make a little scene with them. We will put Pooh and Piglet on the pillows together. Pooh will have his arm in a chocolate candy box. Piglet will have his on the remote control. When the children come back, they imagine that all day long Pooh and Piglet just hung out on the bed, snacking and watching TV. The next day, they find Donald and Goofy dancing on the windowsill. We make a show."
These eight great housekeepers were not just trying harder, nor did they simply take more pride in their work. These great housekeepers had talent. They shared a unique filter. Seen through this filter, a hotel room wasn't just another chore for them to complete. It was a world, a guest's world. When they cleaned the room, they looked through the guest's eyes and imagined how the world should look. Making each guest's world just right brought them strength and satisfaction. No one told these housekeepers to behave like this, but for some reason, their mental filter drove them to these behaviors and to gain enduring satisfaction from the outcome. These individuals were probably some of the best housekeepers in the world. These housekeepers' managers knew that the best way to recognize these Michael Jordans of housekeeping was not necessarily to promote them out of it. They looked for other ways, more specific praise, better compensation, tighter selection criteria for aspiring housekeepers, to highlight these superstars. Guided by the knowledge that great housekeepers possess talent, they did everything in their power to make excellence in housekeeping publicly revered and a genuine career choice. In the minds of great managers, every role performed at excellence deserves respect. Every role has its own nobility. Talent. How great managers find it. Why are great managers so good at selecting for talent? Even if you know to select for talent, it is not always easy to identify those who have it. First, many people don't know what their true talents are. They may be experts in their chosen field, but when it comes to listing their unique set of talents, they are stumped. As Peter Drucker, the elder statesman of management wisdom, says, "Even today, remarkably few Americans are prepared to select jobs for themselves. When you ask, 'Do you know what you are good at? Do you know your limitations?' they look at you with a blank stare, or they often respond in terms of subject knowledge, which is the wrong answer. This confusion is understandable. Your own skills and knowledge are relatively easy to identify. You had to acquire them, and therefore they are apart, distinct. They are not you. But your talents? Your talents are simply your recurring patterns of behavior. They are your very essence. It takes a rare objectivity to be able to stand back from yourself and pick out the unique patterns that make you, you. Second, when someone applies for a job, he naturally wants to impress. Therefore, he will paint the few recurring behaviors he is aware of in as rosy a hue as possible. In the job interview, he labels himself assertive, not aggressive. He describes himself as ambitious rather than pushy,
More often than not, these are not deliberate misrepresentations. They are his genuine attempts to describe himself to you positively. But whatever his true motivations, his instinct to try to impress you makes your job, the talent scout, that much more difficult. These barriers to talent scouting are a fact of life. Human nature being what it is, people will always struggle to know themselves, and they will always sell themselves in job interviews. Despite these barriers, great managers still do much better than their colleagues at selecting people with the right talents for the role. They have discovered some simple techniques to cut through the barriers and find the match between the person and the role. Know what talents you are looking for. In the early 90s, Gallup began working with two of the largest retail brokerage firms in the United States. Both companies wanted help selecting brokers, and both of them defined the role exactly the same way. The broker was not paid to be a money manager, doing financial analysis and picking stocks. Instead, he was paid to be a money gatherer, identifying high potential prospects, and then persuading them to invest their money with his firm. He was a salesperson. Although the definition of roles was the same, each company organized itself differently. One was extremely structured. Each broker spent months learning how to represent the same suite of meticulously packaged products, and regular refresher courses helped keep him from straying too far from the company's mandate. By comparison, the other company was wildly entrepreneurial. Licensed brokers were told, "Here's a phone, here's a phone book. I want to see $500,000 in assets under management by this time next year. Best of luck." Both strategies had their strengths, and as it turns out, both strategies have proven very successful. However, both could not be executed by the same kind of person. Although the job title was the same, broker, and the job description was the same, money gatherer, the talent profiles were significantly different. For the structured company, the critical striving talent was achiever, the burning inside-out push. In this environment of frequent supervision, other striving talents, like the need for independence, were actually weaknesses. The critical thinking talent was discipline, an ability to work in a highly regimented environment. Thinking talents like focus or strategic thinking were much less important because the company, not the broker, set the direction and determined the best routes forward. Any broker who wanted to do this for himself would quickly start to butt heads with the company. He would lose. In the entrepreneurial company, the opposite was true. The critical striving talent was desire, a burning need for independence. And the critical thinking talent was focus, the ability to pick out a genuine prospect from the phone book and to sort out whom to call from everyone who could be called. Lacking these talents, the unfortunate broker would feel lost and lonely, a company man in an entrepreneur's world. A broker with lots of desire and focus is not necessarily a better broker than one with lots of achiever and discipline, but she would certainly fit better in the entrepreneurial company, just as the broker blessed with achiever and discipline would be better cast in the more structured company. Lacking this knowledge, both companies might have ended up hiring each other's brokers with disastrous repercussions. As a manager, you need to know exactly which talents you want. To identify these talents, look beyond the job title and description. Think about the culture of the company. Is your company the kind that uses scores to drive performance and that makes heroes out of those with the highest scores? If so, make sure that the striving talent, competition, is in your profile. Or maybe your organization emphasizes the underlying purpose of its work and confers prestige only on those who noticeably live the values of the company. If so, search for people who possess the striving talent, mission, people who must see the greater purpose of which their efforts are a part. Think about how you will set expectations and how closely the person will be supervised. Think about who you are as a manager and who will mesh with your style. Do you prefer to set short-term goals and check in regularly with each person to monitor incremental progress? If so, you need to surround yourself with direct reports who yearn for structure, detail, and regular updates. People with thinking talent, discipline. Or, are you the kind of manager who likes to hand off as much responsibility as possible and who sets long-term goals and then expects employees to orient themselves toward those goals without much help from you? If so, your direct reports will need the thinking talent focus. Think about the other people on the team. Think about the overall work environment into which this person must fit. Perhaps the team is filled with solid but serious performers who need drama and excitement. Find a person with the relating talent, stimulator, who can find the drama in almost any milestone or achievement. Perhaps the team is friendly but lacks the ability to confront one another with the truth. Look for a person who leads with the relating talent, assertiveness, so that you have at least one team member who feels compelled to bring every issue, no matter how sensitive, to the surface. Perhaps your organization has a strong human resources department that can give your managers detailed feedback on the strengths and weaknesses of each of their direct reports. In this case, you may not need to select managers who possess the relating talent, individualized perception, defined as the ability to identify and capitalize on the uniqueness in people. Or perhaps your organization offers no HR support at all. In this case, relating talents, like individualized perception, or relator, the need to build bonds that last, or developer, the need to invest in other people's growth, and to derive satisfaction from doing so, will have to serve as the cornerstones of your desired talent profile. Pondering all of these variables can be overwhelming, so simplify. Bring things down to size. Try to identify one critical talent in each of the three talent categories, striving, thinking, and relating. Use these three talents as your foundation. Focus on them during the interviewing process. Mention them when asking people for referrals. Do not compromise on them, no matter how alluring a candidate's resume might appear. Study your best. If you want to be sure that you have started with the right three talents, study your best in the role. This may sound obvious, but beware, conventional wisdom would advise the opposite. Conventional wisdom asserts that good is the opposite of bad, that if you want to understand excellence, you should investigate failure and then invert it. In society at large, we define good health as the absence of disease. In the classroom, we talk to kids on drugs to learn how to keep kids off drugs, and delve into the details of truancy to learn how to keep more kids in school. And in the working world, this fascination with pathology is just as pervasive. Managers are far more articulate about service failure than they are about service success, and many still define excellence as zero defects. When it comes to understanding talent, this focus on pathology has caused many managers to completely misdiagnose what it takes to excel in a particular role. For example, many managers think that because bad salespeople suffer from call reluctance, great salespeople must not, or that because bad waiters are too opinionated, great waiters must keep their opinions in check. Reject this focus on pathology. You cannot infer excellence from studying failure and then inverting it. Why? Because excellence and failure are often surprisingly similar. Average is the anomaly. For example, by studying the best salespeople, great managers have learned that the best, just like the worst, suffer call reluctance. Apparently, the best salesperson, as with the worst, feels as if he is selling himself. It is this striving talent of feeling personally invested in the sale that causes him to be so persuasive. But it also causes him to take rejection personally. Every time he makes a sales call, he feels the shiver of fear that someone will say no to him. To him! The difference between greatness and failure in sales is that the great salesperson is not paralyzed by this fear. He is blessed with another talent, the relating talent of confrontation, that enables him to derive immense satisfaction from sparring with the prospect and overcoming resistance. Every day, he feels call reluctance, but this talent for confrontation pulls him through it. His love of sparring outweighs his fear of personal rejection. Lacking this talent for confrontation, the bad salesperson simply feels the fear. The average salesperson feels nothing. He woodenly follows the six-step approach he has been taught and hopes for the best. By studying their best, great managers can overturn many similarly long-standing misconceptions. For example, they know that the best waiters, just like the worst, form strong opinions. The difference between the best and the worst is that the best waiters use their quickly formed opinions to tailor their style to each particular table of customers, whereas the worst are just rude. Average waiters form no opinions, and so give every table the same droning spiel. And the best nurses, contrary to popular opinion, do form strong emotional relationships with their patients. The difference between the best and the worst is that the best nurses use their emotions to take control and smooth the patient's world as much as possible, whereas the worst are overwhelmed by their emotions. Average nurses? Average nurses protect themselves by keeping their distance. They are emotionally disengaged. Take time to study your best, say great managers. Learn the whys, the hows, and the whos of your best, and then select for similar talents. In the end, much of the secret to selecting for talent lies in the art of interviewing. When interviewing for talent, most managers are aware of the more obvious pitfalls. Don't put the candidate under undue stress. Don't evaluate people on their appearance alone. Don't rush to judgment. Avoiding these pitfalls will certainly lay the foundations for a productive interview. However, if you want to excel in the art of interviewing, you need to do more. In Chapter 7, we will describe in detail the interviewing techniques that have enabled great managers to select for talent so unerringly.
A word from the coach, John Wooden, on the importance of talent. Selecting for talent is the manager's first and most important responsibility. If he fails to find people with the talents he needs, then everything else he does to help them grow will be as wasted as sunshine on barren ground. John Wooden, the legendary coach of the UCLA Bruins, put it more pragmatically. No matter how you total success in the coaching profession, it all comes down to a single factor, talent. There may be 100 great coaches of whom you have never heard in basketball, football, or any sport, who will probably never receive the acclaim they deserve simply because they have not been blessed with the talent. Although not every coach can win consistently with talent, no coach can win without it. According to everything we have heard from great managers, the coach is right. But he is also a little humble. What made John Wooden so successful was not just the talents on his teams, but also his own ability to create the right kind of environment to allow those talents to flourish. After all, talent is only potential. This potential cannot be turned into performance in a vacuum. Great talents need great managers if they are to be turned into performance. Selecting for talent is only the first of the four keys. In the chapters that follow, we will present the others and describe how great managers focus, recognize, and develop the talents they have so carefully selected. Chapter 4. The second key, define the right outcomes. Managing by remote control, temptations, rules of thumb, what do you get paid to do? Managing by remote control. Why is it so hard to manage people well? I am ultimately responsible for the quality of all teaching in my district, yet every day in every classroom, there is a teacher and there are students, and the door is shut. Jerry C., a superintendent for a large public school district, captures the manager's challenge perfectly. How can you get people to do what you want them to do when you're not there to tell them to do it? Jerry knows what all great managers know. As a manager, you might think that you have more control, but you don't. You actually have less control than the people who report to you. Each individual employee can decide what to do and what not to do. He can decide the hows, the whens, and the with whoms. For good or for ill, he can make things happen. You can't. You can't make anything happen. All you can do is influence, motivate, berate, or cajole in the hope that most of your people will do what you ask of them. This isn't control. This is remote control. And it is coupled, nonetheless, with all of the accountability for the team's performance. Your predicament is compounded by the fact that human beings are messy. No matter how carefully you selected for certain talents, each of your people arrived with his own style, his own needs, and his own motivations. There's nothing wrong with all this diversity. It is often a real benefit to have a team of people who all look at the world in slightly different ways. But this diversity does make your job significantly more complicated. Not only do you have to manage by remote control, but you have to take into account that each employee will respond to your signals in slightly, but importantly, different ways. If it's any consolation, great managers are in the tightest spot of all. They are further hemmed in by two fervent beliefs. First, as we described in Chapter 2, they believe that people don't change that much. They know that they cannot force everyone in a particular role to do the job exactly the same way. They know that there is a limit to how much each employee's different style, needs, and motivation can be ground down. Second, they believe that an organization exists for a purpose, and that that purpose is performance, with performance defined as any outcome that is deemed valuable by either an external or internal customer. In their view, the manager's most basic responsibility is not to help each person grow. It is not to provide an environment in which each person feels significant and special. These are worthy methods, but they are not the point. The point is to focus people toward performance. The manager is and should be totally responsible for this. This explains why great managers are skeptical about handing all authority down to their people. Allowing each person to make all of his own decisions may well result in a team of fully self-actualized employees, but it may not be a very productive team. So, this is their dilemma. The manager must retain control and focus people on performance, but she is bound by her belief that she cannot force everyone to perform in the same way. The solution is as elegant as it is efficient. Define the right outcomes, and then let each person find his own route toward those outcomes. This solution may sound simple, but study it more closely and you can begin to see its power. First, it resolves the great manager's dilemma. All of a sudden, her two guiding beliefs, that people are enduringly different and that managers must focus people on the same performance, are no longer in conflict. They are now in harmony. In fact, they are intertwined. The latter frees her up to capitalize on the former. To focus people on performance, she must define the right outcomes and stick to those outcomes religiously. But as soon as she does that, as soon as she standardizes the required outcomes, she has just avoided what she always knew was impossible anyway,
forcing everyone to follow the same path toward those outcomes. Standardizing the ends prevents her from having to standardize the means. If a school superintendent can keep focused on his teachers' student grades and ratings, then he need not waste time evaluating them on the quality of their lesson plans or the orderliness of their classrooms. If a hospitality manager can measure her front desk clerk's guest ratings and the repeat visits they created, then she won't have to monitor how closely they followed the preset welcome script. If the sales manager can define very specifically the few outcomes he wants from his salespeople, then he can ignore how well they filled out their call reporting sheets. Second, this solution is supremely efficient. The most efficient route that nature has found from point A to point B is rarely a straight line. It is always the path of least resistance. The most efficient way to turn someone's talent into performance is to help him find his own path of least resistance toward the desired outcomes. With his mind firmly focused on the right outcomes, the great sales manager can avoid the temptation of correcting each person's selling style so that it fits the required mold. Instead, he can go with each person's flow, smoothing a unique path toward the desired result. If one salesperson closes through relationship building, one through technical competence and detail orientation, and another through sheer persuasiveness, then the great sales manager doesn't have to interfere as long as they all make quality sales. Third, this solution encourages employees to take responsibility. Great managers want each employee to feel a certain tension, a tension to achieve. Defining the right outcomes creates that tension. By defining, and more often than not measuring, the required outcomes, great managers create an environment where each employee feels that little thrill of pressure, that sense of being out there by himself with a very definite target. This kind of environment will excite talented employees and scare away the road warriors. It is the kind of environment where a person must learn. She must learn the unique combination of plays that work for her time and time again. She must learn how she responds to pressure, how she builds trust with people, how she stays focused, and how and when she needs to rest. She must discover her own paths of least resistance. Defining the right outcomes does expect a lot of employees, but there is probably no better way to nurture self-awareness and self-reliance in your people. Temptations. Why do so many managers try to control their people? If defining outcomes rather than methods is so elegant and so efficient, why don't more managers do just that? When faced with the challenge of turning talent into performance, why do so many managers choose instead to dictate how work should be done? Every manager has his own reasons, but in the end, it is probably because the allure of control is just too tempting. On the surface, these temptations seem justifiable, but play them out, and each one soon saps the life out of the company and shrivels its value. Temptation. Perfect people. This first temptation is very familiar. Imagine an expert, a well-intentioned expert. He wants to help all employees rise above their imperfections. He looks at all the fumbling inefficiency around him, and he just knows, that if only people would learn his simple steps, the world would be a better place, and everyone would thank him. This expert believes that there is one best way to perform every role. With time and study, he will find this one best way and teach it to all employees. He will make them more efficient and more successful. You, the manager, will simply have to monitor each person to ensure that everyone is sticking to the regimen. Many managers are seduced by the idea that there is one best way and that it can be taught. Thus, they dispatch the salesperson to learn the 10 secrets of effective negotiation, and then evaluate him based on how closely he followed the required steps. They send the budding executive off to acquire the 20 competencies of successful leaders.